Okay, so I'm Rick Hansen, and as usual, I'm foggy on the date. It's March 8th, 2017. Okay, good. And my watch is still in Dubai, which is where I was 2 weeks ago. So this year, I hope to explore, as I've mentioned, relationships, the field of relationships, community, relationship material from childhood, how to practice with that, relationship material in real time, how to practice with that. So that's kind of the broader theme. You may know the story, purportedly at least, I think plausibly, that one time the Buddha and his cousin, his primary attendant, Ananda, were hanging out, basically, amidst a whole bunch of other monastics, I suspect at the time, just male monastics. And Ananda and the Buddha looked out over the gathering and people talking with each other and getting along well. And Ananda said, "Look, noble sir, this is half of the holy life, community." You know, and who knows what Ananda thought the other half was. Maybe he thought, you know, there was like the relational field and then there was the internal realm. I don't know. And the Buddha apparently said to him famously, "Not so, Ananda, not so. This, just this, is the whole of the holy life. Practicing in community, being in community, being in a field of relatedness with ongoing real-time mindfulness." So it's in that context, really appreciating that, also appreciating some modern scholarship that seems to indicate that amidst his teachings, the Buddha said, love, when fully engaged, is a wholly complete path of awakening in itself, and with a real strong emphasis of that, instead of or alongside what could sometimes seem like a pretty dry process of analytical insight and self-awareness. Juicy, embodied love as a wholly complete path of awakening. Wow. So, and of course, in many ways, what ails the world today has to do a lot with relatedness or lack of relatedness of various kinds. So it's a very rich topic field this year. Okay. In that context, I want to mention a couple things tonight and then sort of open it up, get a feeling for what interests you in this territory. The first thing is I was in Dubai a couple weeks ago, and I'd never been there, I'd never been to the Middle East before, and I just wanted to, there were a couple observations about it that I wanted to kind of toss out, as it were. And also, people have asked, what was that like? So, briefly, I got an invitation some 6 or so months ago from the cabinet minister in the United Arab Emirates, Persian Gulf, traditional Muslim, patriarchal monarchy, sitting on the edge of the Persian Gulf, a minister of happiness. They have like a government minister of well-being, happiness, or some term like that. Of course, a woman. You can place it in the context. And so in any case, I got this very dignified letter with, you know, Arabic in it. Whoa, little me. And they invited me to come give a talk on the neuroscience of happiness at the World Government Summit in Dubai. And I kind of thought, another one of those conferences, right? Bunch of therapists, sure, I'll do it. They'll fly me over and back, you know, it'll be nice. Dubai, my wife started to have a panic attack, but no, honey, it's okay. I think Dubai's safe, but well, anyway, so I go. And I discovered that this World Government Summit was actually a big deal. I was a little frog in a really, really, really big pond. The Secretary General of the UN gave a speech. The head of the World Bank, Elon Musk, all these people. I rolled out of my elevator in the hotel conference complex. Andrew Weil was across the hallway getting on the elevator. Saw him catching a taxi in the morning as I was catching a taxi. Seemed like a nice guy, you know, just, and all these other people. It was a really big deal. And the takeaway, though, one key takeaway for me was it made me very hopeful. I went there about 2 weeks ago, kind of when it seemed like maximal craziness, what's going on in American politics, obviously what the fundamental causes and conditions have not changed. But it was like, I'm trying to adapt to the new reality. And I went over there and I felt, honestly, like I was bobbing up and down amidst 10,000 icebergs. And I could see the tip, but under each iceberg were hundreds or thousands of other people or organizations trying to help the world be a better place. Several thousand people came to this conference. There were tons of media. You could see all these, very interesting, lots of people from the Middle East in traditional dress, then lots of German undersecretaries for economics, you know, women dressed for success, you know, walking through the pathway, followed by various aides chattering away, and all these people, and of course, corporate types and business people. It was really impressive, but the thing was, you really felt like they were trying to make things better. It wasn't perfect, but there was a trying to make things better that was actually really hopeful, and it reminded me of how, when I've written a bit about this, if you get my newsletters, you look up at the sky, you see the one dark cloud, right? You look at your nice shirt, you see the one little spot or frayed thread. And we lose sight, negativity bias, of the total ground, and we're sucked into the little figure. And the news is, if it bleeds, it leads. It tends to be so much about problems and negativity and so forth. But meanwhile, in thousands and thousands of ways, many, many people just like us, basically, in their different culture and different focus, different capacities, priorities, whatnot, are trying to cooperate, build rather than destroy, love rather than hate. And it was really, really hopeful for me. So I wanted to pass that along to you. See what you think. The other part of it, though, was, and this is so much about life, was the knowing that this very gracious and generous government, as far as I was concerned, and these futuristic 23rd century skyscrapers. They have the world's tallest building there. They have the world's largest mall. Their mall has a ski slope inside it. All right? All of that is built on, economically, a process of extracting carbon out of the ground, selling it, and pouring it into the sky, and is in a context of a completely traditional patriarchal monarchy, and is based on the labor, often indentured servitude, exploitation labor of millions of foreign workers. Both true. Which goes to so much about relationships. One, continuing to sustain mindfulness. The Buddhist teaching so often is really about recognizing what's true. Surrendering to what's true, receiving what's true, widening out to include all of what's true, nothing left out. And so it's the seeing of what's good in the other person amidst what's irritating you or worrying you or is a genuine problem in the other person. Seeing what's positive and moving forward and progressive in the, you know, progressing in the group or the family, you know, or the company or the country and the world. That's one takeaway. The other takeaway is the capacity to hold both things, that this person you love may have a mean streak, that this minister and organization in a government that's trying to do good things is funded by bad things. And to be capable of seeing and holding the whole, including applying this kind of seeing to oneself. Seeing so many progressing, cooperating, building, constructing positive movements inside oneself amidst some other stuff, right? One's own mean streak, or reactive tendencies, or addictive tendencies, or, you know, neurotic residues. Okay, but that's alongside inside oneself, being in relationship with oneself, not just relationship with out that which is outside oneself, seemingly. So many good things, so much beautiful sky of mind is the case in here, even as those occasional clouds of crud, raining doo-doo, you know, inside the mind, roll on by. right? Far out to be able to do that. Okay, so that's one offering, right? Second offering is to draw your attention to the embodied sense of being in relationship. And I liken it a little bit to listening to music. What I mean by that is when I initially landed there in this big hotel, conference center, lobby, and so forth, I had never been in a Muslim culture. The people were very gracious, very dignified, you know, very in their place. The gender roles were very strict in the people, the Emirati people, belong to the seven emirates that are united there. But simultaneously, as long as people weren't too crazy, there was complete relaxed integration of, we could say, more Western or modern styles all the way around. But still, it was kind of shocking to my body. You know, I grew up in West Covina, Southern California. You know, I was not in Kansas any longer. This is really different. And so the body naturally tends to contract, to pull back, you know. And if you're like me at all, someone who, you know, managed life by going up into the penthouse suite, dead from the, numb from the neck down, you know, what elevator, right? I was up here. What basement? What 30th floor? I was at the 100th floor. But anyway, you know, it's a natural tendency to kind of flight upstairs, right? But then you start to realize that, wait a second here, alongside these other people, my body's doing just fine. I'm going on being, it's comfortable. This is what it feels like to be with these other people. And very often, we don't really include or integrate the somatic sense, the somatic track, the somatic markers of relatedness, including tuning into other people empathically, as we explored when I was here a couple weeks ago, or reading the signals from our body as to what's happening, or communicating with people in a way that comes from a more embodied place, that we're actually feeling our feelings in our body as we communicate our feelings. Real-time integration, you know, of inclusion of what's actually happening. It's a little bit like a friend of mine who is a semi-professional musician said that in rock and roll, at least, I don't know, in general or maybe other things, his view and his teacher's view was that the heart of the music was the bass guitar. I don't play music, but it changed the way I listen to music. I started listening for that beat, the bass guitar, which is what we often dance to when we're dancing and we're really in the music. It's a little bit like the somatic sensations of ongoing relatedness, interacting with other people, talking with them. That's the bass guitar. And it's easy to miss, kind of tune it out, because the melody, the words, the meanings, the interaction, my mind, your mind, off and off we go. It's easy to just stop listening to the bass guitar line, the body line, the somatic line in the ongoing song of experiencing. And yet it makes it so much richer. And it's such a way to include real-time mindfulness of all the tracks of our experience. The thought track, the emotion track, the desire track, certainly, and the sensation and action tracks in the flow, you know, of our experience. I want to offer that. And if you're really good with that one already, if you're way deep in the bass line, and some people are so flooded with body sensations, it actually helps them to dial them down a little bit. But I think most people, including in our go-go, zoom-zoom, weirdly disincarnate, you know, out of touch, not grounded in nature or the body, or slow enough to really bring the body along as the mind zooms down the highway, you know, verbal thought, 100 miles an hour. For most people, I think this inclusion of mindfulness of the body is really, really important. Samuel Bonder has a nice phrase, we need to wake down, not just wake up. That's my second offering. Okay, kind of goes together. And then third, I'm going to be drawing on this collection of teachings from the Buddha, and you might be interested in getting this book. It's a nice anthology with a very good editor, Bhikkhu Bodhi. And I'll just read you the title. This is The Buddha's Teachings on Social and Communal Harmony. Boy, we could use more of that these days, right? Social and Communal Harmony, an anthology of discourses from the Pali Canon. Pali's a language, canon's a collection of teachings, oral discourses handed down for centuries with very careful memorization, probably some noise slipped in, but a lot of signal has remained, which then got written down a few hundred years after the Buddha passed away. And that's the Pali Canon, which is this rich body of teachings that's come to us today. And in a good translation, is really quite powerful. So I want to read to you the foreword by the Dalai Lama and then kind of see what you make of all this. Okay. So I'll read most of this. Okay, so he says, the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni, lived, attained enlightenment, and taught in India more than 2,500 years ago. However, I believe that much of what he taught so long ago can be relevant to people's lives today. The Buddha saw that people can live together freely as individuals, equal in principle, and therefore responsible for each other. What a great connection, equal and responsible as a possibility. He saw that the very purpose of life is to be happy. He talked about suffering in the context of ways to overcome it. He recognized that while ignorance binds beings in endless frustration and suffering, the development of understanding is liberating. The Buddha saw that every member of the human family, man and woman alike, and I would add beyond those distinctions as well, has an equal right to liberty, not just in terms of political or even spiritual freedom, but at a fundamental level of freedom from fear and want. He recognized that each of us is just a human being like everyone else. Not only do we all desire happiness and seek to avoid suffering, but each of us has an equal right to pursue these goals. I think I'll leave it there, preserve time for discussion. Okay? All right. So, it's the beginning of the year, sort of, opening it up. Let's keep going. All right, please.
Can you just tell us briefly why you were invited to these thousands of other folks?
Why was I invited to this conference? I was invited to give a talk on the neuroscience of happiness. And I was one of multiple people on that topic, which to my, it's like, what am I doing here? Pinch myself. The Prime Minister of Bhutan, a number of top-tier academics, including like Robert Waldinger from Harvard, who has monitored and managed the 75-year study of adult development, various business types. So that was it. And then they slid more into the whole government thing. So in my short answer, I think I lucked out. Yeah.
You're being humble.
Well, it's true. And I have some expertise in that area. They somehow stumbled upon me, but I was so glad to be there. What an experience. And, you go there. Here's the thing, too. Like right now, it's 8:11 in the morning. People are having breakfast or walking around. Here's a really funny thing. In this hotel complex, they had a bunch of restaurants. They had a Mexican restaurant in Dubai. All right, okay, fine. I grew up in LA, a lot of Mexican restaurants. So I'm sitting at this Mexican restaurant, my final meal, just hanging out. And there's a family next to me. And it was, they looked like they're in their early 30s, man, woman, and like a 3-year-old boy, just having this this kind of family meal together, chatting away. She was wearing glasses. He was, just kind of hanging out. And also, he was in traditional Emirati headdress, white robes. I think it's because the men don't do any work. I won't go there. The women were in black, only the face revealed. And so this is juxtaposition, completely traditional setup, absolutely ordinary. I could have been sitting next to another family, young family with a kid they just loved dearly, in the Terralind and North Gate One Mall, right? Just hanging out at the Mexican restaurant or something there. And both being true at the same time. And so that's true for other people simultaneously. One of the, for me, amazing things is go to these websites. They're like high-level scientific-type website that tracks the world's population. So this counter is changing. There are three counters. One is the best estimate of total world population. Another spinning dial is births. It's going quite fast. And a slightly slower spinning dial is deaths. And in real time, you're seeing all this happening. And it's, again, it's that larger whole. All right. Comments, questions? Yeah. Jerry.
So from the Poly Jerry. Canon just now, there was that phrase from the Poly Canon just now. There was that phrase, responsible for each other.
Yeah.
So there's a lot there in that saying. So what do you think the Buddha meant by it? Mm. And how is it applied to today's world, do you think?
So to say back to you, you know, there's that phrase, right? That if you live on the basis of equality, that takes you right into responsibility, right? And benevolence, basically. And I think that the Dalai Lama is, you know, adding his Dalai Lama gloss on that. He's highlighting that. And it popped out for me as well. Like, wow. To put those two together. And so what I know of through, you know, the teachings that have come down to us is really, if you think of what's in the New Testament that's kind of clearly attributable to Jesus, it's really it's a small fraction of the words of the Bible, really. And the Quran, it's one document, pretty much. There's a lot of teaching around it, right? You know, the Buddha left a major record behind of his teachings, for better or worse. There's a lot there you can see. So it seems that in all that, there's definitely an emphasis on personal responsibility. You know, from a moral standpoint, everyone has their own karmas. Otherwise, there can't be a morality. And I mean karmas in this life, where karmas like hitting golf balls in a shower, right? In this real life, right? So as he said in his final teaching, as we best know, he did not appoint a pope. He did not create a priest caste that we're to defer to. Monastics, yes, to be respected and listened to and supported, but judged as well for the depth of their real practice. He said, be a light unto yourself, that part. So that's one part of the truth. I think that's very, very, very fundamental on the one hand. On the other hand, in ways that were radical at his times, people know. I mean, there was think about patriarchy 2,500 years ago, rural, feudal, northern India. And he, after he was pushed, ordained women and established in his view that in principle, a man or a woman, and again, I think it's important to think about the people for whom those distinctions are not liberating, they're confining, problematic, but man, woman, and a priest, or rather a monastic or layperson, all four categories had equal access to awakening. So in that sense, they were definitely on the same level. They all suffered. Everyone suffers. Everyone longs. You know, we're the human tribe, right? And that was really quite radical. He busted through the whole structure of the caste structure of his time, the Jain religious structure, in which there were these hard distinctions you were stuck with. He said, no, good news, you're not stuck. Bad news, you have to earn your own awakening. No one can awaken you. You have to do it yourself. Grace, mystery, yes, but you have to light your own lamp. And use it for yourself. So that's quite remarkable, isn't it? So that egalitarian principle. And certainly as monastics, and there's a lot of monastic code. You don't own any property as a monastic. It's very egalitarian. I mean, there is some loose hierarchy. And then obviously social forms that are problematic, cultural forms get laid in. But in the basic principle, there is that quality, right, of being at the same level. And where that works for me to... I don't know if you know Virginia Satir. She's a, back in the day, no longer alive, really profound family therapist. She would do workshops with people. And she would do various things around basically saying, show me your navel. Who in this room I've got $1 million for the person in this room with no navel. Right? We're all born in blood. We're all born in one way or another. We're, you know, we all feel that. We all have that connection. We all are tied to our mother in utero, certainly, and many other ways. You know, we all have that. We're all that. We all suffer. And I think there's something about that where you allow the magnitude of the other person's suffering or joy or good heart, all of it, to land on you. That's very egalitarian. So what comes from that then? What comes from that? And, you know, to your point, Dalai Lama talks about responsibility. And I think very much the Buddha's teachings around compassion are to be really wide open to recognizing the pain of other people. And not just recognizing it with a shrug of the shoulders, but being moved to do something about that. You know, wide open to that. And you may know the Metta Sutta, the pretty well-known Loving Kindness Sutta. Again, I'll bring it in. We've passed it out before. I'll do that again. It's really, really quite beautiful. And one of the key phrases in it is omitting none. You know, he says basically, paraphrasing, you know, as a mother cherishes her child, her only child, so we should cherish all beings, the great and the small, the high and the low, the known and the unknown, omitting none. So it really goes there, right? And we'll go through a lot of teachings around non-harming. You know, the core moral teaching of the Buddha is non-harming. The core wisdom teaching is see clearly. See, you know, with the eye of the heart, the eye of the body, you know, recognize clearly. So we have wisdom and compassion, you know, the jewel and the lotus. So with other people, maybe just to finish here, it's to realize, especially if you take it more into the Mahayana, the Tibetan, you know, Tibetan, Chinese, Zen teachings, that we all awaken together in a way. So we each have our own practice, and you can see that people vary in how kind of purified they are, or how much kind of crud's washed through, or just, you know, steadiness of mind, other factors. But on the other hand, we're all kind of all in this together, right? And what the heck, I'm going to lay this on you. So think about the Buddha and the time he lived. It was agricultural, so it was 7,500 or so years after the advent of agriculture, which could produce a surplus, but they still lived in a really small agrarian way, small villages, kind of small kin, small family networks. They lived in many ways with the structural conditions of hunter-gatherer bands. In which, and I want to offer a view to you here, three conditions were present that for the last 10,000 years very often are not present, which makes governance difficult. First condition was that the truth was obvious. You could tell who was eating more. You could tell eventually pretty fast in a small village, a small kinship group, who's sleeping with who. You know? You could tell whether someone's word was good. You could see if someone said, as a leader, this is my plan, and it doesn't go well, the results were pretty obvious. You know, people died, people starved, it was real. You know, the facts could not be hidden. There was no fake news. It was very, very, very real. You know, just imagine the natural governance structure for the human species that we evolved in and were optimized for governance performance in the context of involves about 30 adults in a band of about 50 people. Think about that. That's the natural governance structure of the human species. That's what we're optimized for, 30 people or so. So, second condition, what happens to you happens to me. What happens to me happens to you. You're my kin. I share genes with you. Or we're kind of up close and personal. If you go down, you drag the whole band down with you. We can't hunt as well. We can't eat as well. It affects things. Your immediate family really cares about you. That affects everybody else. It ripples really fast, right? And I can't hide from the impacts on you of me getting rich and fat, right? That's going to hurt you, and that's going to blow back to me really quickly in a group of 30 or so people. What happens to you happens to me. And the third condition for governance then, and you can see it as well in many ways in these monastics situations, leaders could not hide from the consequences of their actions. There was no place to run to. There were no gated mansions. There was no, you know, city on the hill with a moat. You were vulnerable to the impacts of other people. And those conditions, you know, were very present. They weren't quite as fully present as in Paleolithic times, hunter-gatherer, Stone Age bands, but they were really quite present in those times. And that tends to flatten hierarchies. You know, those three conditions, right? The truth is obvious, pretty much. You know, what happens to you happens to me. Bonds of, you know, sort of like common truth, common welfare, and common justice. You know, and in many ways, I think, I've been reflecting lately, that the deep underlying causes and conditions of much of what's problematic in human governance over the last 10,000 years, and we can see it in Technicolor, you know, with a very rapid news cycle today, is the lack of those three conditions when you have 7.5 billion people organized in very large scale, you know, city-states, nations, and empires. So just to offer it to you, I'm kind of going for it there, but I've been reflecting a lot about how to name those conditions, name the lack of those conditions, and then beginning to think about how to rectify them in some way for the whole human tribe in the 21st century. And that's a big question I don't have all the answers to. But I think some of the answers were operating at that among those people at that World Government Summit. Okay. I hope I didn't blather on there. What do you make of all that? What do you think?
Awesome. Principles you laid down from early times of the natural size of the human pod, 30 people, and the conditions that you know, automatically or naturally existed. It's really profound, I think. You know, it hits me.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Other people, yeah.
One of the things that I noticed in, when you were talking and invited us to really feel the sense of community is I all of a sudden, you know, and I do this from time to time in my practice, I feel really connected. And what I notice is that, like you, I live in my head my whole life, and I realize how much I feel disconnected as a result of just living in my head, having my own brilliant thoughts, you know. And it's very isolating. And just as a therapist, since I always think about this, just how much of our therapy and our culture is about talking and being in your head. And since I've, you know, now that I'm old and I do meditation and yoga, how being in my body just feels so much more healing and connecting in some ways than blathering onto myself in my head.
Yeah.
And that lost somatic sense that we don't really cultivate in our culture, it just makes me so sad that we, you know, don't have, I think we've lost that sense of community and being together because we are so disembodied and stuck in our intellects.
Yeah. I know, it's kind of wild when you think about being with other people. It's a body being with a body, right? But we tend to really go up in our heads, but it's a body with a body, and then just to kind of feel that, without getting weird about it, but, you know, to feel it. Did you have a, please.
Yeah, well, this conversation here reminded me of this concept called Buddhist economics. And the writer talks about how we are living in a world where, you know, consumption and greed is to the demise of our civilization and all that. And that bigger is thought to be better. These are old concepts, like, you know, where it led to think globally, act locally. But I'm just wondering what your comments would be about how we are, you know, here studying about, you know, equality and we're living in such a paradox because it's so antithetical to the way things are now. And I'm thinking from like an economic point of view that that we want more and more and more, and trying to dominate other societies, and then we're getting bigger and bigger. And the Buddhist economics principle talks about how, similar to what you said before, about being equal and thinking more about the person rather than the productivity and the, you know, producing things and things and things, but it's more important for people to be employed and have purpose,
yeah,
than to have to acquire things. And so I don't know, I guess I'm kind of thinking out loud here, but my question might be, you know, how do you sort of hold on to those principles when you're living in such a paradox? You know, everything around us is so opposite of all of these teachings in some ways.
Yeah. Well, that's a huge, huge, huge topic, including realizing, you know, I mean, it's like when I went to Dubai, and the way I framed it was sort of like they are sitting on top of and benefiting from, you know, a lot of harmful processes and practices. You know, we live in an economy that's very extractive relative to the rest of the world. You know, much of this country was built by slaves, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, to hold both those truths. You know, I live on land that used to belong to the Miwoks. I look in my backyard, I love my backyard, and I totally get people were walking through there. It's a watershed 3,000 years ago, feeding their families. So it's complex, you know? And I think it's important for people in my position in this role here, and also my own nature, to not lay a trip on people. But on the other hand, you can't not have values. So it's to both try to speak to facts, but also speak to ought, is an ought. It's a classic distinction. And so then bringing it down to earth a little bit and, you know, moving toward an end here tonight and, you know, an encouragement around practice. When, you know, it's, you probably know the history of agriculture. In hunter-gatherer bands, you can't store things. Our modern anthropological understanding, including hunter-gatherer bands living in the world today, is there are hierarchies, but they're a lot flatter, really. You may have some special feathers because you're the chief. You may, you know, get the first piece of the meat, but it's the hierarchies are much flatter of wealth, you know, resources, and power. Much, much, much flatter. And when you have, to your point there, and the Dalai Lama's point is those hierarchies flatten toward equality, egalitarianism, it becomes, self-interest becomes more and more collective. Personal good and common good. I mean, with surpluses, you can then structure a situation where the personal good of the top 1-5% in terms of wealth and power is not the common good. And the common harm is not the personal harm. Make sense? And so that's part of the huge issue. So what do we do about that? And I think, for me at least, to the Buddhist fundamental teaching, ignorance is the root of suffering. It's seeing what's true, including, and this is where I think it's a moral act and even a political act, in the face of those who would try to deny what's true or cloud our gaze toward what's true or undermine our trust in our own recognition of what's true. Trust me, they say, not your lying eyes. Well, maybe your eyes don't lie. And I think that's really important, and to call it out and to stand for that. And that does tend to cut through a lot of the tyrannies of this, of inequalities, which work a lot out of, denying or obscuring what's actually true. That's, I think, a piece of it. And then finishing on that point, which I think is, again, very close to the Buddhist teaching, and what you brought up there, is to really include our impact on other people. In other words, as much as we can, flatten the hierarchy. There might be distinctions of roles or capacities, age, energy, life structures, you know, resources of various kinds. But as much as we can, I just think about it where we really meet being to being, navel to navel, right? We horizontalize. The power structure falls away. We truly try to level it with it where we meet being to being. We're both going to die. We don't want our children to die. You know, we both have lived and loved and lost here, right here. And when we can meet in that way without that inequality, without that, you know, tilt, if you will, then it fairly smoothly and immediately moves into a mutuality of caring and welfare for each other in a very natural way. And I think interpersonally, that really is where a lot of rubber meets the road. You know, not giving, the Buddha said, give no one cause to fear you. Maybe give them cause to recognize there will be consequences, like you won't get dessert if you don't do your homework. Okay, there's a place for that sort of thing. You won't have a job if you don't get your job done. Okay, there's a place for that. We're not going to be in a relationship if you keep cheating on me. You know, okay, there may be consequences. But it's not about intimidation or threat or domination games. It's not the play of the traditional alpha, you know, trying to dominate. And so we really take into account our impact on other people, even if it's not our intent. There's that idea from diversity work that we, even if our intent is neutral or benign, but if our impact is harmful, we really try to be open to seeing that and trying to sort out what's wise about that. And I think that shows up a lot in relationships, thinking about what's it like for you to be with me, with each person we see, walking down a street. What's it like for you to be with me as I walk on by? What's it like for our partner, our coworker, our children? What's it like for our children, our adult children perhaps, to be with us? And do what we can to try to level it, especially if we have privilege. Ta-Nehisi Coates got the MacArthur Prize, beautiful writer. He said privilege is, this is a close paraphrase, privilege means not having to take things into account. The more that there are inequalities, the less that those who benefited from them have to take the rest of the tribe into account. And I think a lot of what the moral path is, especially where the rubber meets the road in intimacy with other people, including people we work with, know loosely as well as our true intimates, is continually stepping out of what privilege gives us so we have the courage and the heart and morality to really let them land and fully take them into account and have them experience that as well and what the benefits of that are. Make sense? Into account. How about we just sit with that for a minute? Be well. See you next week, I hope.